It's time to think bigger.
Elias Pettersson scores!
And think bolder.
Matthew Tkachuk, what a goal!
This is Rintoul and Sermon.
Another chance, great save by Markstrom.
Here is shot, rebound, great save by Dimko.
On the Sportsnet Radio Network.
They're going to play at least one more. That we know. Hope your Tuesday's off to a great start. We're going to make it better. It's Rintoul and Sermon. The hockey season is not over quite yet, Karen.
No, we are not talking about a parade through Tampa Bay today, Scott. What kind of parade they were have. The Montreal Canadiens did what they needed to do last night. One point, though, I didn't think we were going to get here, but we'll talk about that as the show goes on. I'm happy to be talking about hockey still, at least games on the ice.
It's not a bit we do, but it does fall into the category of I'm not saying, I'm just saying, because I'm not telling you I believe it, but there is a similarity to something with what we saw last night, and we can get to that throughout the course of the segment. 960-960 or 650-650, you can always get in on the course of the program. Mike McKenna is going to join us. He'll have some interesting insight in this series because Nick Suzuki was really good again last night, and he's had himself a whale of a playoffs. In my estimation, he was the second ever draft pick in Vegas Golden Knights history. Just part of our conversation. Goaltending obviously was a part of it last night. And you need a little puck luck somewhere along the way. Carey Price had a couple puck luck moments from his posts. Braden Point got one on the power play. Nikita Kucherov got one late in the game. But it all evens out. Montreal's got a healthy dose of it last night. There's nothing to apologize for. In fact, if you step back and look at this series, Montreal was the far better team in Game 2. It probably should be 3-1. It just might not be 3-1 the way we've gotten there.
Looking at that game early on, Scott, I don't know about you, but I thought, oh my God, Tampa's going to roll Montreal. I mean, they had to rely on Carey Price. It took, what, just over 8 minutes before the first shot on Vasilevskiy for the Montreal Canadiens. It just seemed that we were destined for like a 4-0 victory for Tampa Bay. So I think that goes back to the storyline that we've talked about. So in these finals so far in the first three games, and it was the fact that Carey Price hadn't stolen them a game so far in these playoffs, and he was really good early in this game, and it bode well for Montreal. Montreal got to play a little bit more as well, the style that they want to play. They got the lead, and we talked about again, they've never got the lead in this playoff series so far. They did. I understand the fact that Tampa Bay came back twice in this game, but once they got the lead, you just see the confidence that they have, and it's almost like Carey Price had more confidence as well because he knew that the next one in wasn't going to be potentially a game-winning goal.
Well, I'm interested to talk to McKenna about this as well. We go through the psychology of goalies all the time, and it certainly didn't work out this way in Game 3 when there were some pucks directed on Carey Price and they found their way past him. Sometimes you get that volume of shots early. It gets you into a rhythm of the game. At the other end, you're waiting. It's not as though Vasilevskiy was bad last night, though he had a couple of moments we haven't seen in this series. Almost had the stick-handling gaffe behind the net that cost him. Ultimately, it did not. It felt a lot like Game 2 in the sense that the team that was dominant early did not get rewarded for its efforts. And it was that counterpunch. Montreal got it. And for as many great storylines as the Montreal Canadiens have authored in this improbable playoff run, the most impressive team accomplishment outside of the wins themselves, we've talked about it throughout the playoffs. And it got the ultimate litmus test last night. It's the penalty kill. It's been an historic penalty kill, one that went on a run that we've never seen before in playoff history. And if you were to give Tampa Bay its opportunity to clinch the cup in the next goal win scenario, like the best possible scenario would look something like this. A 4-minute power play at the end of regulation and bleeding into overtime if you don't get the job done in regulation. Tampa Bay would take that. We've talked about their superpower being their power play, and yet it did not find a way to beat Carey Price in that moment.
0-for-5 with the fifth one being a 4-minute double minor for a high stick by Shea Weber on Andre Palat. He was bleeding and leaking right away. John Cooper is making sure that the actual linesman called the penalty there. You look at that, and I don't know how you thought, but okay. First off, my first initial thought was, okay, Montreal, just get to the end of regulation. It's 1 minute, just get off the ice. If you can get through this, then we'll see what happens. And then my initial thought when we got back from overtime intermission was, and I literally said this to my boyfriend, I said, Tampa Bay is not going to go for 0-for-5 on the power play. Like, they just can't. You can't keep giving them this many chances, and they're not going to cash in. And I don't know if Tampa was not ready to start the overtime, or it was the fresh ice, or it was what Montreal was doing, but they did a pretty decent job of killing off that penalty. And, you know, when you do kill off a penalty like that, it's funny how quickly it can end in the back of the net on the other way, right? Like, it just seemed that, like, as soon as that Montreal got through that penalty kill, and hey, they had that shorthanded chance as well, Philip Deneau to Nick Suzuki, but Vasilevskiy makes a great save. And it just seems, you know, sometimes you get that momentum back, and looks what happens, puck ends up in the back of the Lightning net.
I don't know what felt longer, the opening sequence of the game in which Montreal just could not touch the puck and could not register a shot, and you said it was over 8 minutes. It felt like two periods. It felt like Montreal did not touch the puck in that opening period. So I don't know if that felt longer or the 3 minutes of penalty kill. It's one thing to get through the last minute of regulation. Your adrenaline, we got to get this to overtime, guys. Then you sit down. You take in the reality of the situation. You're right about Tampa off the hop in overtime, but they had 3 minutes to deal with. So there's not an urgency right off the beginning. You're starting at center ice. You're not ozone draw like you normally are. And then they settled in, and then they directed four pucks on net, and there was a shot block in there, and there was a missed shot attempt in there. But you're right. They survived. And the playoffs, with that playoff existence on the line, as you mentioned, the Habs go 5-for-5. This is a Bolts team that came into last night's game 36.7%. in the playoffs prior to last night. That's how good they were on the power play. Just for any type of historians out there, this century, this is the best power play we've seen with a team that's gone to the Stanley Cup final. Like, Colorado is at 41% this year. Well, Colorado only played two rounds. Mm-hmm. Teams that have gone on to play all four rounds of the playoffs, no team this century has had a better power play than Tampa Bay. Now, they might fall below that mark if they can't get a power play marker in the last one, but right now, even with last night's 0-for-5, they're at over 33%. They're fantastic. They're 2-for-12 with the man advantage in this series. That feels like a win of sorts against Tampa Bay with how potent that thing is.
It's funny because you keep giving me these stats, and I'm like, keep thinking, well, then how did they not score with five power plays last night? Like, logic suggests that they should have scored on at least one of those power plays. Montreal does a really good job of being really aggressive on the puck. They're aggressive when they dump the puck back into Tampa Bay's zone. They always have someone there chasing, forcing to make it difficult for Tampa Bay to get it out. It helps that Carey Price made some big saves. It also helps luck. You mentioned off the top, John Cooper's famous quote after the game saying, would you change anything from last night's game? He says, yeah, maybe not hit so many posts. And a lot of those posts, you have to be lucky some of these times. Montreal has not had the puck luck in this series. It went their way last night. Can I also talk about the fact that Shea Weber looked like he was about to destroy Braden Point at multiple points in that game? Like, he was a man on a mission from the beginning. And I'm really happy that he didn't end up being the GOAT in the terms of the negative term, because he was the guy who took that high stick minor on Palat, or double minor on Palat. But man, oh man, it just seemed that he was going to will this team to win that game last night up until that penalty he took. And it seemed that the rest of the team just gravitated from how aggressive he was going to be. And the refs let them go, and it was just fun to watch.
Who inflicted more pain on Braden Point, Shea Weber or Victor Hedman? That blast from the point. Man, I worried about Point returning to that game and maybe this series.
I did as well. Like, I thought, to the point where, it's hard, his name's Point, same point. I thought he was going to literally not be able to come back. Like, if you take a puck right above that plastic, right above your kneecap there, like, I could only imagine how a slap shot from someone not named Victor Hedman would hurt. But, man, the guy's got a killer release. And I thought Braden Point was maybe done for the playoffs, missed a couple shifts, came back. So good for Tampa. Maybe not so good for Montreal going forward. But a couple of those times when Shea Weber took a run at Point, the one where he basically took a run from halfway across the ice, and, again, if he hits him full on, Braden Point may never come back in this series. Like, it looked like he was a man on a mission out there. And I did also like the fact that, they were also going after Nikita Kucherov last night.
They were very physical. They were physical in a way they hadn't been yet in this series. Mm-hmm. They were nasty in a way they hadn't been in this series. It's something that's going to have to continue if they're going to do any more staving as soon as tomorrow night. We think tomorrow night. This is assuming the tropical storm that is about to hit Florida at some point this evening doesn't do too much damage and that all is well tomorrow. Let's keep our fingers crossed for that. I don't know what the adult equivalent of this is, and maybe there isn't one. Maybe you have to go back to your teenage years. Maybe it's sitting outside the principal's office, or maybe it's when your boss calls you and says, hey, we need to have a meeting, and is very vague, and you don't know what it's going to be about, and then you're sitting there waiting for the meeting to begin. Shea Weber sitting in that sin bin last night in overtime for the first 3 minutes, and they had the shot where Tampa got the chance, Price made the save, there was no rebound, and it showed Weber, and you could see the big exhale and him tapping the stick against the boards like, okay, let's go. You could tell how nervous he was. You can imagine what a helpless feeling that would be.
It was, and the look of just, he had like a blank stare every time they went to him early on in that penalty kill, because you know, you don't want to be the one, you're the captain of this team, you have had such a good game so far, and the fact that you're the one that could cost your team the Stanley Cup, it's just, that must have been weighing on him. You're probably trying not to think about it, but I'm just happy that was not the case. Like, he gets to have a little bit of redemption with the fact that he did take that. And it was reckless with a stick, but he was trying to lift the guy's stick and it came between his legs and, you know, hit him with the blade and it just didn't look good. And hey, the ref didn't even see it, Scott. Like, the linesman had to call it and the ref was really looking at it right there too. So I'm glad for Shea Weber that his season did not come to an end last night with him sitting in the penalty box.
Shea Weber wasn't part of the post-game festivities, if you will. As far as Zoom goes, Brendan Gallagher was. A fellow BC boy was asked about killing off a penalty for his captain.
I mean, Weber's our leader. He can't ask for a better teammate. So obviously, I think the guys wanted to bear down, especially for him. I mean, we understand the situation we're in. I think we would have killed it for anyone. But, you know, he's been a rock for us since he's come to our team. The physicality that he brings that you speak of, you know, that's just what you expect from him every single night. He's hard to play against, and especially as these series go on, he's a pain. So happy to have him on our side.
Text comes in. They didn't want to score. They want to go back to Tampa and win. They didn't get to last year. Hey, if it all works out, you're right. I'm guessing Tampa Bay didn't feel that way. It's a weird thing with this team, as good as the Tampa Bay Lightning are. You go back their last six series. Only once in their last six series have they closed out an opponent in the first opportunity. It was Carolina in the second round this year. Every other opponent, when they've had a chance to close out a series, they haven't gotten it done the first time. Now, ultimately, they've won all of those series, but they didn't get over in the first game. It's a weird thing, and we always hear, hey, the fourth win's the toughest to get. It's something else I want to talk to McKenna about. Why is that? Like, what's the difference? And I wonder if there's a different vibe on the team knowing that you can close it out as opposed to, well, it's the opponent and the desperation.
It is weird because last night, I mean, you watched that game. You watched it early. You watched the entire thing. Like, it could have easily been Tampa Bay's game. We could be talking about today the fact that it's Stanley Cup champions, Tampa Bay Lightning. It's not like Montreal Canadiens outplayed Tampa Bay. It was a very even game last night, into the point where Tampa dominated early on and did have those five power plays. But there may be something, you know, that comes with winning a championship's hard. And you're playing against a team that has a lot of pride. Especially, like, I know last year they're in the bubble, but, you know, Montreal doesn't want to have Tampa win on their home ice. They don't want to see them paraded around. Do I think Tampa tried not to score last night? No. I mean, they hit some posts. They were doing everything they could to win that game because you don't want to give Montreal an opening. You don't want to do what Jane Castor, the mayor of Tampa Bay, said, like, take it easy on them, then we can win in game five. Because guess what? A win in game five is not exactly guaranteed, especially if you look at the way Montreal played in game two. In Tampa Bay. Like, they played well. They should have won that game. So, no, do I think that they wanted to lose just so they could go back to Tampa Bay? No, I think that's that's something that we can talk about, but that's not talked about in the locker room.
Tampa Bay mayor, there's nothing to see here unless they have to go back to Montreal. Then she starts to catch a little bit of heat, and it's the, oh, be careful what you wished for. If this all works out and Tampa wraps this thing up tomorrow night, Amalie Arena, home ice, fans going crazy, packed house. It's all good. Got what you want. Title town. Another one. And this time, just like the Bucks, you get to do it at home. They go back to Montreal for Friday? She's probably asked a couple of questions on Thursday about this.
Tampa Bay owner likes it. He gets to make another $2 to $3 million. That's from Dave. Yeah, he probably does like it, because did you see the 15,000 people that were in Amalie Arena yesterday? That's a significant boost, but now you get to have another full arena for game five. Not bad deal. This is something I noticed and I tweeted out after the game, and this text comes in from Shane Aldergrove. Is there a calmer goaltender in the game than Price? I can't even think for a close second. He walked away after that game like he was, like it was a loss. The look that they showed of him, the ISO on him, Scott, where he's watching the play. You realize the goal went in. He grabs his water bottle and skates off the ice. I understand it's not a victory in sorts because you're still down 3-1, but you think there might have been a fist pump or something like that? No, just another day at the office.
We saw this with Carey Price after they eliminated the Golden Knights in Game 6. And we talked about how he didn't celebrate. He didn't celebrate at all. We played the clip from his interview that was super heartwarming to watch and told you a lot about Carey Price, the person. The only time he lit up that entire interview was when he was asked about his family. It wasn't about going to the Stanley Cup final for the first time. It wasn't about doing something for the organization that hadn't been done in a long time, maybe breaking the drought for Canada. None of that got a rise out of Carey Price in the slightest. His pulse did not quiver. You mentioned his family. He lit up. That's just how this guy rolls when it comes to hockey.
It's just, I guess hockey's just his business for him. You know, he's very passionate about his family. He also didn't, he was pretty stoic when they were introducing Patrick Roy. they did a little ISO on Roy, and then they went to Carey Price. He's just, I am focused. I am not going to know that the greatest goaltender in the history of our organization, one of them, is in the building. It's just, it is. It's for him, it's business. And if he wins the Stanley Cup, I'm sure then we'll get a celebration out of Carey Price. But it just struck me as there was nothing to show that he was happy that, you know, we're going to game five. It's like, okay, business done. Off we go to Tampa Bay.
Now, as I said, I'm not saying, I'm just saying. When Montreal began its comeback against the Leafs, it started in somewhat similar fashion. Not exactly the same. Montreal got off to a great start in that game. Game five of the opening round. Went up 3-0, but then blew a 3-0 lead and had to head to overtime. Nick Suzuki got the bailout goal that time, extended that series. This time, it's Josh Anderson. I'm not saying, I'm just saying. If Montreal begins to mount a comeback, it has started at least in the similar vein. Like, you're as close as you can be. Everybody that's listening out there today, if you played hockey at any level, if you just played road hockey, at some point playing pickup, you went, okay, next goal wins. Montreal was on next goal wins. And the Stanley Cup was going to be decided last night. They've been next goal wins a couple of times. They are 4-0 in elimination games thus far. Josh Anderson was great last night. Everything he did was every reason why Marc Bergevin brought him to town last night.
He was, and you don't see it every game with Josh Anderson, and I'm not exactly sure why, but he was on point last night. When Nick Suzuki, that first goal that Josh Anderson scored, and Nick Suzuki went behind the red line, I thought he was actually trying to pass it to Cole Caulfield, but it was a perfect pass, just a little saucer pass off the ice. Josh Anderson comes in, backdoor, beats Vasilevskiy. It was a great pass and a great finish. And then everything on the overtime goal, like the fact of how difficult it is to lift Yanni Gord's stick. He gets the puck off his stick along the boards. The speed that he showed to get the puck, driving to the net, and the fact, too, that he didn't give up on the play. Like, he got back off the ice, came around, the puck sitting right there for him to score. He's on his ass when, you know, after the play finishes. It's just, it's prototypical power forward, and he was, again, you talk about Shea Weber, Josh Anderson was another guy on a mission last night.
Josh Anderson, after the game, on the Habs, doing a little staving.
We didn't want to end it tonight in front of our fans. You know, we expect to go to Tampa tomorrow. I think everybody in that locker room did, and, you know, packed their bags, you know, this afternoon. We just had that feeling that we were going to win tonight and give ourselves a chance, you know, and go there, take care of business, and, you know, come home in front of our fans. So, you know, we're in a good position now.
I don't know if they're in a good position now. I don't even know if we have a series yet. We go back to Montreal on Friday, we've got a series. They need to win one more to convince me this is an official series yet. I shouldn't doubt them after the first round, but that's where I'm at with this team.
Well, I guess the good position is the fact that they're not done. They're lifting to see another day. They're going to go back to Tampa Bay. The series is still live. You never know what can happen in a game. Maybe they get some more bounces. Maybe anything can happen. So it's exciting in the fact that we're not talking about a sweep, because we could have talked, our conversation today, Scott, could have been, was this one of the more disappointing Stanley Cup finals of all time? Like, honestly, we could have talked about that, because the expectations going in were, okay, Montreal on the Cinderella run, what can they do? They've came out of the North Division, they beat the vaunted Vegas Golden Knights, and then, nope, Tampa was just way too much for this Montreal team. So I'm stoked to have at least one more game to talk about. Gives us content for the next couple of days. But again, what I saw from this Montreal team is what I saw from them against Toronto and what I saw from them against Vegas. It was the team that we believed could make a run at the Stanley Cup. They just played a different style of hockey last night. But Tampa's just so good. Like, it's just, it could easily go, it's a coin flip if they play that way. Montreal can play as good as they can, and Tampa still looks like, okay, they should still win this hockey game.
Coach deserves a little credit here, though I'm not sure I agree with the Kotkaniemi move. Big picture. Now, he's got a relationship with him. Kotkaniemi sat the first two games of the playoffs, so they've been down this road before, but this was a Stanley Cup game. This is supposed to be part of your youth movement and part of your foundation moving forward. It has nothing to do with Jake Evans, who was really good last night. Mm-hmm. Ducharme does deserve credit. He made some bold moves. He took two guys off the defense. He put two guys out there. One of them scored a goal in Romanov. He gets his first goal. What a reaction by him. He puts Kulak out there. He's instrumental on a goal as well last night. Mm-hmm. Dominic Ducharme made some big swings yesterday, and you have to tip your cap whether you agreed with them or not.
It's funny, because did you see the flash to Romanov and Kulak on the bench and Luke Richardson trying to give these guys a pep talk because of the fact that Petrie and Sherratt were in the box for 2 minutes, ended up being 6 minutes by the end of things. But Romanov gets out there and he scores the goal, and it's like, okay, what pep talk are you giving them? And then Romanov was kind of a bit of a goat on the other turn, because he was on the ice, had a bit of a gaffe when Tampa scored the game-tying goal, the second goal of the game. But hey, in the end, you win the game. You look like a hero in terms of the decisions that you made. I'm with you with the Kotkaniemi. I mean, if you're going to look at big picture for this organization and he's going to be part of it, you know, what kind of message does this send? But he has to know the player better than you and I do. He's done it already in this series. You have to think that it's just a no hard feelings type of situation.
That's one of those funny scenes. It happens every once in a while in hockey, and it wasn't as many players as in that Tampa-Florida series to kick the playoffs off. They had three guys for each team in the box. It always looks funny, doesn't it? Anytime there's more than two of each team sitting in the sin bin together, it looks funny. And last night you had three Habs, you had three Lightning players sitting there, the entire energy line, identity line, whatever you want to call that for Tampa Bay, they're all sitting there together and they're celebrating together. And then you've got Petrie and they're all in there at the same time.
Right.
It always looks hilarious.
I thought to myself, that's a pretty close quarters for coming out of a COVID situation. That was the first thing that I thought of, Scott. It was a pretty funny situation. Can we also talk about the fact that Patrick Maroon is just ridiculously good? Like, he was on a bit of a, you know, a bit of a mission last night as well. That fourth line, Matthew Joseph gets inserted in for Alex Killorn, and he played really
pass.
Well last night.
It's
really
a great pass.
Well. Back in his own province in Quebec. Probably, you know, different outcome of that game. He's celebrating a Stanley Cup in his home province. Would have been really cool. But Patrick Maroon, just, he looks like one of those guys that just wants to win a third Stanley Cup in a row.
Is he that good, or is he just that good of a role player? You know what I mean?
I loved him when he played for the Oilers, and that was that 2017 season when they went to the second round of the playoffs. I believe it was his second year with the team. I can't remember. I was really choked when they let him go. He wanted to go back home. He wanted to go to St. Louis. That's where his kid was. Hey, he won a Stanley Cup there. Kudos to him. But he's a player that just brings this energy. And if you need a moment in a game where you're going to need some sort of momentum shift, like, he's the guy you're going to throw out there to try and get that for you, whether it be a hit, whether it be some sort of aggressive play on the ice. He's that player. I think he knows his role, and he fills it really well.
He certainly does. Patrick Maroon looking for three straight cups, two different organizations, and he's the guy who said, part of the reason I came back and part of what I'm urging these guys on, we didn't really get to do this the right way. I saw it in St. Louis. I know what it's like when your fans are there, when your family's there. He and the Lightning, despite losing last night, get that opportunity tomorrow evening. Mike McKenna will join us next. He does so every Tuesday. Yeah, we're going to talk hockey, but I do have to investigate a tweet he sent out last night. I'll explain next on Rintoul and Sermon.
We're not going home!
That was not Carey Price. That was Anton Hudobin, one of the great clips from last year when the Dallas Stars netminder got the big chain after the game, and that was what he said in the bubble in Edmonton. We're not going home. We have another connection to that team coming in to the program later on. Rick Bonus, the head coach of the Dallas Stars, awesome, will join us later on in the show. Great goal by Josh Anderson, a little stave and done by the Montreal Canadiens last night. Patrick Maroon provided that type of goal that gave Tampa Bay a chance to clinch the cup. And it looked like Montreal might be able to see things out. Great pass from Joseph, great finish by Maroon. And we're headed to overtime, and Tampa's got a power play last night. It's Rintoul and Sermon, joined by Mike McKinnon in just a second. You asked me during the break a question about Patrick Maroon. I got the question wrong, which is why Patrick Maroon now belongs in a certain category of athlete for me. What is the question you asked me?
I said, how old is Patrick Maroon?
I said 37. He's got to be like 37.
Really? No,
he's not.
He's 33. He's 33 years old. I mean, he's not young, but he's not, you know, towards 37-year-olds towards the end of his career.
Okay, so he is far younger than I am, and he feels to me older than I am when I watch him. Part of it has to do with the fact that he doesn't get around out there particularly well. He's not the fleetest of foot. Obviously, the skill set he brings to the table is at a premium in the playoffs. Lack of time, lack of space. He can push people around. He's got a lot of wear and tear on the old big rig. He feels way older than he actually is. And you know what I'm talking about, Karen. There are athletes that are like this, and they've been around forever, and you've covered them forever, and you've talked about them forever. And then you see how old they are, and you say, no, he's got to be older than that. Come on, that guy's got to be way older than that.
There are a lot of guys that you think about that. To me, it has to do with a lot of the facial hair. Like, Patrick Maroon looks a lot older. Nikita Kucherov, when I looked at the fact that he's 28 years old yesterday, I'm thinking, nah, like, he looks like he's at least 33. But then I'm thinking, maybe it's just, you know, I'm not used to the facial hair. It just makes people look older. Who is it? Bruce Bowen was one of those guys, too. I mean, probably because he was around, and for those that don't know, Bruce Bowen, NBA basketball player, won some championships with the San Antonio Spurs, had a really good career, but he was one of those guys when you always looked at him because he started early and just was moved around to different teams that you always thought, okay, he's at least 42 years old.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Of course. And there are a bunch out there. And hit us up, 960, 960, 650, 650. Is there an athlete out there who feels ancient to you? And yet, birth certificate, actual fact, that athlete is much younger than what we actually perceive him or her as.
And this one coming in from Marcus and Gibbons, Robin Lehner looks older than he is. How old do you think Robin Lehner is?
Oh, Robin Lehner is probably 29 or 30.
Okay, you got it, 29. I would have thought he would have been 33. Just because he's been around. I think it's when you have journeyman too, and not journeyman in terms of, I think, yeah, journeyman in terms of amount of teams that they're on too. Like, you just, when you have a guys that jump around from teams for whatever reason, that kind of adds to what I think their age is.
Part of it is a look, and you mentioned this with Kucherov when we were having this discussion in the break. You said with that beard, he looks way older than he actually is, which is on the right side of 30 as far as professional athletes are concerned. He's on the younger side. He's 28 years old right mm-hmm. now. Robin Lehner, when he had the long hair and the big beard, he
yeah.
looks older than when he decided to take her all the way down to the wood just prior to the playoffs and shave it off.
I was going to say Rafael Nadal because I'm watching tennis, but Rafa looks his age right now. He's older and he looks his age just because he's balding, Scott. So a lot of it has to come with facial hair and length of hair.
This one comes in from Rager, Chris Tanev. Feels like he's 35 or 36,
yes,
but he's only 31 years old. And again, there's a guy who's had a lot of wear and tear on his body. He's been around for a really long time. He burst into a relatively prominent role with a really good team early, and he's been talked about a lot. That's a really good one. I think a lot of people would agree with that Chris Tanev feels like he's older than 31.
Landon Donovan gets a shout-out from this text inbox. Scott, Landon Donovan looked really old really fast. Now, that could have to do with soccer players. You lose your speed pretty quick bit there. Again, does it have to do with the hair?
Hairline. Yeah, with Landon Donovan, I think it was the hairline coming back that probably did it there. I'm not sure if Mike McKenna feels as old as he actually is. See, Mike McKenna, who's about to join us right now, Vegas Golden Knights analyst, Mike McKenna, to me, looks younger than he actually is. Mike, would you agree with that assessment? Do you hear that often?
Well, it just depends whether you're looking at my hair or not. It's exceedingly going gray, which I don't mind. I got a full mop up top, but I do get that occasionally. I am 38, and I don't know, man. I've tried my best not to blow up when I got done playing, and that's just I don't want to end up being the guy that looks like somebody stuck an air hose in my stomach and afterwards not no longer an athlete. I'm still trying to put out this facade that once upon a time in my life, I was a professional athlete. So I appreciate the compliment in looking younger than I am.
Well, and you've got the tightly cropped hair. That helps. And you have youthful activities, things like skateboarding. We talked about going on the wakeboard last week. So that
it's all a facade.
Helps. Yeah, sure. We don't get to see the afterwards where you need to get worked on, because I want to know how many chicken rings you crushed last night. You tweeted out this picture of 12 chicken rings for $2.99. You said that's a great deal. I have questions. What is a chicken ring? Where does it come from? How is one made?
Well, I'm sure you could probably think of some creative things of where a chicken ring may come from, but I believe it's just pressed chicken, much like a McNugget or anything else. But White Castle, you know, it's a phenomenon in the Midwest. It's kind of everywhere in the U.S. now at this point. There's two installations in Vegas, and I tell you what, 12 of those suckers for $2.99, that is a steal of a deal. They really dip well. You know, that's the strength of the chicken ring, is that whatever your dipping sauce of choice is, they really do a nice job at kind of soaking it up, and you can get the desired amount on there. And I mean, obviously this is just a completely terrible form of food that's got no redeeming value other than the fact that it's round, it's chicken, and it tastes delicious. But White Castle is a real weakness for me, guys. I mean, I used to go with my grandpa and be, you know, a number one with extra pickle and a chocolate shake. So, you know, I hope everybody in Canada gets the chance to experience White Castle at some point in their life, because it's a cultural phenomenon.
Yeah, the only time I think of White Castle, I think of Harold and Kumar. That's the only time I think of White Castle.
You are the Harold and Kumar of this program, Mike. That is who you are.
That's fine. I'll take it.
Yeah, we'll introduce you.
I just don't know whether I'm Harold or Kumar.
We can have our listeners debate about that, whether you're Harold or Kumar. Mike McKenna, former professional goaltender, Vegas Golden Knights analyst, joins us now. Let's start with the goaltenders. We often do. Carey Price, he saw a lot of shots early last night, and we often talk about this. Oh, I got into a rhythm. How much involvement do most goalies, how much involvement did you like early in a game in order to establish a rhythm?
Yeah, I think it really matters the first shot or two that you face. It's tough to get much going if it's a tough opportunity. You know, if you face a 2-on-1 or a breakaway, or even if you go straight on the penalty kill to start a game, that's a tough scenario. You're always hoping for the big floater from the blue line for a first shot right in your chest. You know, just cradle that thing, get the whistle. I think a couple of those shots are always good for you. You just get the feel of it. You can only do so much in warmups. And for myself, I really appreciated when I got a chance to handle the puck. And it's just like for Carey Price, it's the same way. When he gets out of the net and gets the puck on his stick, and he makes a couple good passes, you know, you're involved in the game. That was a big reason why I like to handle the puck so much. I love to be out of my net. I love the puck on my stick. I didn't want to just let it go around to my defenseman. I wanted the puck. So I think that helps a lot. You know, any goaltender will tell you that you're hoping for a nice floater or two to start things off and just to get things off on the right foot. But, you know, you can't affect that. Sometimes you face that breakaway and you make that big save, and it gives you a jolt of energy too. So it can go both ways, but I think we're definitely looking for something a little on the easier side for the first couple shots of the game.
So Mike, looking at the first, probably say 10 minutes of that game last night, if that was games 1, 2, and 3, Carey Price probably would have thought a goal would have gone in. He just didn't quite look like himself in those first three games. The rebound control was not quite there, as pointed out from Kelly Rudy on the broadcast. What did you see between last night's games and maybe the first three games of the series with Price?
I just felt that he was working harder to find pucks. You know, first three games, it kind of felt like he was a little bit back on his heels and not as active as he needed to be to get his eyes on things. And when you talk about rebound control and everything that goes along with it, it all comes down to tracking and positioning. And, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine that was my goalie coach for years, Chris Economo, and you know, he's just convinced that Carey Price is the greatest positional goalie to ever play. And I can't argue that. I think he's right. Like, his skating, his positioning is so good. But it's only when he tracks the puck well and when he's actively finding pucks. You know, the times where you've seen Carey Price or, you know, even like a Tuukka Rask, you know, these are the goalies that sometimes can lull themselves back almost into mediocrity when they're not as engaged as they need to be. you know, when they're just getting on the ice and going, okay, just be calm, play the game. You still need to have a little bit of fire in you. And I think we saw more of that out of Price last night. Obviously, in the first period, he was huge for them because, to me, Tampa was – you saw the best version of Tampa early, man. They checked, they held pucks, they're hard on the walls, and Price had to be on his game right off the bat.
I believe Carey Price going up against Tampa Bay up until that game last night was 0-12, especially against Andrei Vasilevskiy. Is there such a thing? I don't know if you've ever had someone where it's like, is it a team or is another goaltender that could be in your head? Like, is that a thing?
I don't think the other goaltender as much, but you'll always, it is in the back of your head that you haven't won against somebody or that you haven't played well. And it's, why does this guy have my number? And you can have great games and not win. But for whatever reason, it doesn't come together. I remember I had that against, it was against Hershey of all teams in the American Hockey League. I could not win against Hershey, it felt like. And I probably went the better part of like 6 or 7 seasons, it seemed like. And finally got this shootout win, you know, later in my, and it just was this huge weight off my shoulders. I'm like, I did it. I got a win here, you know, and you face that sometimes. But the weird part is that when you get to playoffs, all bets are off. You know, and a couple years later, I had a great playoff series against Hershey, not far removed from finally getting a win against them for the first time in forever. So, I mean, it plays into it. I think that you definitely can get in your own head too much and thinking, man, I just can't beat this team. When in reality, every game's different. You know, it's just probability. You roll the dice, you either win or lose. But sometimes it can feel like there's more stacked against you than there really is.
Vegas Golden Knights analyst, former professional goaltender Mike McKenna joining us here as he does every single Tuesday. The penalty kill has been incredible for Montreal these playoffs. It was last night, and boy, did it need to be at the end of regulation and in overtime. Mike, what separates great penalty killers from average ones?
Well, there's two things to me. I mean, it's just will and desire, first off. You have to have those. You got to be willing to block shots, and you got to be able to move your feet. It's not as simple as just clogging the middle and hanging back and being able to eat pucks and willingness. You got to skate. You know, a defenseman, you still have to be able to get to the corners to force pucks, to get to the walls. Forwards, you've got to trigger quickly and be on loose pucks as quick as you can, get them down the ice. I think that's a huge factor, willingness. But I think it's intelligence, too. You know, some of the best penalty killers to ever play the game may not be the fastest, but they're the smartest, and you can account for whatever your skill set is in a complementary way when you can think the game so well. Mark Stone's a great example of that with Vegas. I don't think they allowed, when him and Chandler Stephenson were killing penalties this year, they didn't allow a single goal against. They were plus. And Stone's not the fastest skater on earth, but that guy can think the game at a level beyond 99% of people in the National Hockey League, much less on this earth. And with Montreal, I just see willingness to work. I see a smart game plan. And I think you see a backbone, and not just Price, but Weber. Having that veteran defenseman on the line that you trust, that's an absolute warrior, that he just commands respect. It's the same way as when Chris Pronger played. Weber's about the closest thing to a Pronger that's left these days in terms of that type of player. Price, Pronger, skating, pack the middle, all those things play into it.
Victor Hedman, because you brought that up, I know he's not quite as far that way as a Shea Weber. Is he underrated in the nastiness department?
Tough to say, because everybody knows he's hard to play against. I don't know if the nasty level really registers with people. Like, as you allude to, Scott, like, you don't think of Victor Hedman as a nasty player. But I think any elite defenseman in the league has an ingrained nastiness to him. An elite defender, you know, not your pure offensive defenseman who's going to go down on the rush and put up 80 points a year. But I think your shutdown date players, your top end defensemen that people fear in the league, there's a reason why. And they're going to put the stick on you. It's going to hurt. Every time they hit you, you're going to feel it. And Hedman, with that big frame and as strong as he is, he's definitely got that edge to him. You know, I think that, again, like, my reference point a lot of times is Vegas, right? Because that's who we cover the most. And Alex Pietrangelo has that. He could be a nasty player when he wants to at times. And I think that's invaluable for a D. You need to have a little bit of fear in the other team if you're going to be effective.
Mike, Montreal has shown a ton of resiliency in these playoffs. And you could probably speak to the fact of they're killing off that 4-minute double. Minor for the high sticking at the end of a regulation, mm-hmm. then leading into the first 3 minutes of overtime. It just points to just how they're not willing to give up. And again, they're probably not. The likelihood is they're probably not going to win the Stanley Cup. Just odds say that, but still, it just shows how resiliency they have. Where does that come from? Is it the head coach? Is it like Carey Price and Ned? Is your captain? Like, where does that come from? You think with this team?
They're just battle hardened. They've been to overtime so many times this season and in playoffs that they know how to get it done. And that's such an abstract quote. Yeah, they just know how to win. Well, you know what? They do. They know how to win in overtime. Look at their record. Look at Montreal's record when they score first in a game. I mean, if Montreal scores first in the next three games, I wouldn't bet against them. The chances they win the Cup's minuscule, but I wouldn't bet against them. They're a different team when they score first. And that penalty kill, it's almost like the moment they got that killed off, you knew they were going to win the game. It just has that feeling to it. Teams that play a lot in overtime and are successful can replicate it. And the best teams that I was on that went the deepest in playoffs all had that character trait to them. They were all strong in overtime. We won games that maybe we shouldn't have by the looks of what the score sheet said. But the reality is all that matters is who scores the most and at the right time. And you know, Montreal's dangerous. That's a team that if they just get one chance to go the other direction, they can put it in. Josh Anderson, I mean, the guy's he's a Cy Young winner. You know, he scores twice as many goals as assists, but everybody in the league fears him because the moment the puck's on a stick, you know it's coming at your net, it's coming hard, and it makes a goalie nervous. And there he was last night, two goals again. So Montreal's got the firepower to score when they need to in spurts. If they could find that more often and if they could get the lead early, I don't know where this series is going to go.
Okay, I don't know if you have an answer for this or not, but this is something I've talked about a lot over the last couple of years, and it holds up in the regular season. It's held up in the playoffs as well. You score first, you win so much more often than you don't, and it's never been easier, theoretically, to score goals in the National Hockey League. It's never been easier to come back with the way some of the rules have changed, and yet that stat holds up. There's no team in this playoffs that has better than .500 record when trailing first in a hockey game, but we've got almost every team that has a winning record when they scored first this postseason. And that holds up in the regular season as well. Mike, most games are open with a goal in the first period. There's a lot of time left to come back. Why does that stat hold up?
You can lose a game in the first period, but you can't win one. And we hear that so often. It's so true. I remember a couple of years ago when Tampa really started to get on their roll. You know, they'd go out, they'd pot three goals in the first, and it'd just be cruise control. It'd be all over. And in the regular season, that really plays. And by playoffs, though, Tampa started to run into teams that all of a sudden could make it happen in playoffs as well, which made it harder on them. But I think just playing with the lead gives you so much confidence. You know, you're not down in a hole. You're not coming from behind. And it can be daunting in the league, no matter how many goals you're down, to try to continually come back from that. And the more often you lead, the more you have that good feeling about yourself. And I think that was a big reason why Vegas bowed out this year, is because when they got to playoffs, they just couldn't bring it in the first period. And they'd been used to doing it all regular season. And when you throw it yourself out of loop like that, when you're used to scoring first, it makes it harder. And Montreal is just, when they have that lead, when they get out in front, man, they just bring it. They carry it. And some teams are better than others at it. But it's just, it's funny to see how much that one goal in a league where the typical score is what, 4-3, 3-2, that one goal, that first goal means so much, but we see it night in and night out.
That one goal that opened the scoring last night was scored by Josh Anderson. It was assisted on a great feed from Nick Suzuki, who was excellent again last night. I know, as a guy who follows Vegas, you probably watch Nick Suzuki a little more closely. He's the second ever draft pick in Golden Knights history. It's the Pacioretty deal that made Nick Suzuki a Hab. Is there any buyer's remorse whatsoever in the VGK, the Vegas Golden Knights fan base?
Well, if you talk to my good friend Brian Slagle, owner, CEO, everything of Metal Blade Records, he's always going to be sour about this one. He loved Suzuki from the time he was drafted. And so I think the people that really, really are in tune with hockey, the super fans of hockey, might have some buyer's remorse with it. I don't think the general fan base does, considering how many goals Max Pacioretty has scored over the course of his tenure as a Vegas Golden Knight. But I do think that there's starting to be a little bit of creeping doubt, just because Pacioretty's been injured so often come playoff time, or not 100%, and the scoring has dried up on occasion. Whereas you see Suzuki start to really come into his own, and you see him too, his position playing center ice, you know, that's a position that the Golden Knights need some help with going forward. Seems to be the case. So the hard part is that hindsight always makes things look different. You know, the Golden Knights gave up Eric Brännström to the Ottawa Senators, and he's hardly been able to crack the lineup in the Mark Stone deal. So how do you look at these things in retrospect? You do have to give up assets. You have two teams that went to the floor. But I do think that Suzuki's a rising star that people would have loved to have on the Golden Knights. But if they can win a cup next season, I don't think Suzuki's name is going to be in the lexicon as often. But if this starts to continue to be a trend, then I think, yeah, maybe 4 or 5 years down the road, you may look at it a little bit differently.
He's Montreal's leading playoff scorer. Right now, is 16 points in 21 games. What growth have you seen in Nick Suzuki throughout the course of this postseason?
It's just a continuation of his game in general. I think that he's been more responsible in the postseason than early in his career, especially. I remember last season watching him and thinking, this kid's got the pieces. And you know, right now he's a good fantasy hockey player, but what is he going to be in the real world when it comes time? And well, we're seeing him perform now. Not just his points going up, but you know, his plus minus and his advanced metrics have been better. But I see the confidence on the power play as well. You know, like he's willing to move his feet to get to places. He's doing all the things that made him a good player in the Ontario Hockey League, finally transferring. And we say finally because it's a year and a half down the road, which is crazy. You know, these kids are so young and so good when they come in. But at 21 years of age, he looks confident. And I think he's got a nice combination. You know, spending a lot of the time this postseason with Toffoli and Caulfield, you got players that can skate. You got creativity in Caulfield, scoring ability. Toffoli can motor. So it's just one of those things where it's a player coming into his own, learning the defensive side of things, which allows him to get the offensive chances necessary when you create turnovers and go the other direction. And he's got the skill on his wings to be able to propel him.
So you're going to throw on some sort of compilation from Metal Blade Records, jump on your skateboard, go get yourself some chicken rings now, right?
Yeah, I mean, you pretty much nailed my entire Tuesday here, Scott. I mean, I might factor in a little bit of watching some wrestling. I've got to catch up. You know, I've got a Monday Night Raw later this month that I'm going to visit with my kids. I'm wearing my RK Bro shirt right now. But yeah, you got me pegged, Scott. We've really gotten to know each other
absolutely
over these couple of months.
Absolutely. Hey, great conversation as always, Mike. We appreciate it every single Tuesday. Who knows? Maybe we're talking about a lengthy series the next time we do this on Tuesday. Really appreciate the insight once again today.
Anytime. Karen, Scott, always a pleasure. Have yourselves a fantastic Tuesday.
Thanks, Mike. It's funny you were talking about Nick Suzuki because we saw a little bit in the bubble last year, right? And I think that's what got Habs fans excited as he raised his game in the bubble. I mean, just a couple of series, but still he did. And, you know, he had a fine regular season. But what I like about him is when the stakes do get higher, he's able to raise it to the occasion. And he's a really good kid. I interviewed him when I was covering the World Juniors a couple of years ago when it was in Vancouver. Very respectful, very intelligent and thoughtful as well. So it's not a surprise to me that his game has been able to translate well to the NHL game. And hey, he's one of the guys, Scott, that's come back in the playoffs from an 0-3 deficit. He did it in his junior career, so maybe that can translate to the NHL.
Yeah, it might be able to. Great hockey family as well that spans generations with the Suzukis. And there's a guy that, as Mike said, makes you rethink these deals. Okay, we're giving up a little futures, but when you're ready to win now, as Vegas has been ready to win since day one, unbeknownst to them when they drafted their roster, but they suddenly found themselves there, you're willing to give up futures. And sometimes those futures turn out to be what Nick Suzuki looks like he's going to be. It's fine if you win. It's fine if you win. And Vegas, there's nothing really to complain about. They've been to three Final Fours. They've been to a Stanley Cup. Like, it's been a pretty charmed existence in the National Hockey League. But if you don't close, you always think about what might have been.
And I don't think they'd say regret getting Max Pacioretty. He's been a great performer for them, especially in the playoffs. But when you think about what their one need is, Scott, what we've always talked about, it's a dynamic center. And it just is like, okay, the one thing that you really need that you think could get you over the hump to the next level is a Nick Suzuki type player. And you had him in your system, but you wanted to go out big game hunting a little bit sooner than maybe what you should have. But it's fine. I mean, like you said, they've been to the Western Conference Final 3 times in 5 years. They're a good hockey team, but this is a player you think could help them out.
I'd love to know the behind-the-scenes dealings. Was Montreal actually asking for Cody Glass? Did Montreal target Nick Suzuki? Was Vegas higher on Cody Glass and said, well, you're not getting him. We can talk about other prospects. Remember, their first two draft picks were centers, and Cody Glass might turn out to be a fine National Hockey League player. Suzuki has obviously made some of these jumps a lot earlier. If Glass had done what Suzuki's doing, maybe we're not talking about this, but yeah, they're looking for that next guy down the middle. Who knows? Maybe they have him in the pipeline. It's tough when you watch Suzuki doing what he's doing right now, and he actually played a big role in vanquishing the Golden Knights from the playoffs this year. Lots going on today. We haven't even touched on any other sports so far. Was there anything at all to glean from what Gary Bettman said last night? It was a short interview. Something we can touch on next, and we've got some really good submissions. Players who you feel are way older than they actually are. We'll get into some of those next on Rintoul and Sermon.
Now back to Rintoul and Sermon.
Yeah, this is a really good one. Kyle from the Islands got a good one. Good submission coming in. Athletes who look a lot older, or you think they're a lot older than they actually are. Sometimes that has to do with coverage, Karen. These people burst onto the scene. A lot of these athletes so young now, and we've known about them for so long that it feels like they've got to be older than that, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, that John from Vancouver said the exact same thing. Players who start NHL careers at 18, their ages deceive me. Matthews and Marner are five-year vets, and they're only 23. I was like thinking about this with like Connor McDavid. Like, he's 24. But also, he looks, because he's got like he's grown in the facial hair. Like, he looks like he's a lot older than he is. But you also think he's been around in the league for 6 years. Like, it's just ridiculous that he's only 24 years old.
How old is Connor Bedard going to seem to us when he's about 3 years into his NHL career? Because we've known about him all of a sudden since he's 15 years old and he gets granted exceptional status. We're talking about him at the U8 teams this year and how great he was, and he's a couple years away from even being drafted, let alone us having this conversation about him being older than he is. And that is a part of it. Sometimes it's just the way somebody looks or wear and tear on the body. Kyle from the Island, this one is good. Phil Kessel looks closer to 40 than 33. Yep, Kessel looks a lot older than 33. That's fair.
He does, absolutely. Brett Connolly looks 50. That one that just got texted in. That's very true. He looks a lot older. This one is perfect to me because it plays for the Lakers, because the first thing I initially thought was, this guy looks like, yes, he's probably 40 or 45 years old. Alex Caruso. People, if you've not seen Alex Caruso, go Google him. He plays for the Lakers. He's a guard. He's a little guy. He wears a headband, but he's also got that balding hairline a bit. He does shave it, so it's like it's pretty close cropped. But he does look like someone that's about 40 years old. That's a perfect one for me.
Yeah, I think he looks slightly younger than 40, but it is a good one. I don't want to disagree with that one too much. He does look a lot older than he actually is. This one came in, I think it's fair as well. I thought Mark Stone was well into his 30s, says this texter. Surprised he's only 29 years old. That one's fair. And again, I think that has to do with the way Mark Stone gets around the ice. He's never been a great skater, but part of it's that he plays the game pretty hard. And the long hair, the beard, maybe that's part of it as well.
It's longevity in the league, how long we've been talking about it. And again, a lot of these guys in the playoffs, because they've got the grizzled playoff look, it looks like they're a lot older than they are. Have you ever had, Scott, I'm sure there's comparisons for you. If like people are like, this is who you look like. You know, they always pick star, whatever. And for me, mine was Felicity Huffman. And not in the news as of late for not good things. She did go to jail. Was part of the...
I hope that wasn't part of the comparison.
No.
Okay, good.
I have not said put in jail.
Excellent.
But
I'm glad to hear that.
If you look back at her Desperate Housewife days, she's blonde curly hair and I've got blonde curly hair, and you know, I can see the comparison. But I went and looked when someone told me that just a couple of years ago. She's 58. I'm like, okay, like I get the comparison, and thankfully I'm not compared to her now, and she looks phenomenal right now. Like, she's 58 years old, does not look like it. But I'm like, so you're comparing me to this actress who's 20 years my senior. Okay, that's, I guess I'll take a note on how I look right now.
But if the comparison is, well, she looks way younger than she actually is, and that's why I think you are a comparable, then that's kind of a nice compliment. But you're saying maybe it's backhanded based on actual age.
Maybe it's a little backhanded. I hope it's not.
Owen and Burnaby texts in, Jordan Staal feels like that guy has been around forever. This is true. It does feel like he's been around forever. He's 32. He turns 33 come September.
Okay, so Greg, our producer back at the station, just said Sam Gagne. But doesn't Sam Gagne still look like he could be like in his early 20s?
Early 20s is a stretch. I would say Sam Gagne looks like he could be in his 20s, which isn't that far off. But I wouldn't say early 20s. I wouldn't say Sam Gagne looks like he'd be in his early 20s. He's had the beard in recent years. That is part of it. And listen, I know a lot of young people have beards now. But a beard ages you a little bit, unless you style it in a certain way. A beard is going to age you naturally, isn't it?
I will say the first picture that comes up is him in an Oilers uniform, and it probably is the picture the first time he was in the Oilers organization. He does look like he's 12. Like, he looks like he's going to be one of those younger-looking guys for the rest of his career.
There are certain people who just fit into the category. Hit us up. Joe Thornton looks like he's 65. Yeah, that's fair. Yeah,
that's fair.
Yeah. It does.
Beard is not helping him. Like, come on, dude.
And it's very gray, obviously. There's a lot going on with Thornton that makes him look even older than he actually is, which is second oldest hockey player in the National Hockey League to Zdeno Chara, if memory serves correctly. Hit us up. 960-960-650-650. Was there anything of consequence that came out of that interview with Gary Bettman last night, or just more of the same?
I think it was just more of the same. It was just like, our officials are the greatest officials in any league, and they don't make issues, and it's not them, it's the players, because the games ramp up. Like, it was just more excuses on that front, and even when Rob McClain tried to, like, press him on, say, the cross-check rule, which is coming to the forefront in the playoffs, he basically pushed that inside and just kept saying waxing poetic things about his officiating. I thought maybe the one interesting thing was when he was talking about the Olympics. And we did hear about it in his press conference prior to game one of the Stanley Cup final, but he got a little bit more into it about, you know, why the holdup and is there a drop dead date? And I did find it interesting when he said, oh, we're well past the drop dead date, but we're still going to try and figure out a way if we can to get to the Olympics in Beijing. We still want to work with our players, but it was kind of just a, well, we're well past it, but we're still going to try and do the best for our players.
Well, it was just trying to make sure that the league and its governors were painted in the best light possible. Hey, if it were up to us, we would have made an announcement by now. But we agreed to this. We're going to support our players. Our partnership is stronger than ever. If they can work out the details, they're going to the Olympics. It's kind of what I heard last week. I know some took issue. I know some were more worried about players going to the Olympics. I think the worry level should be the same, but it's not pointed in the same direction as the past. It shouldn't be directed at the league here. Gary Bettman, more clearly last night than he certainly did last week, said, we're going as long as those financial and legal issues work themselves out. A lot of it has to do with insurance as well, and it does feel like the players need some assurances from either the IIHF or the IOC or a combination of the two that they're going to have certain wishes met or they aren't going to be able to go.
So they have a board of governors coming up. Is it Thursday is what they said on the broadcast last night, Scott? Either this week or next week. And it's an update again, the situation where they're going to be. They're not going to have an answer with the IOC by then. My concern is the fact that we are still, 2.5 weeks out from the start of the Summer Games. And then literally 8 months later, they're supposed to have the Winter Olympics. And my concern is that these two being close together is just not going to give the IOC time to negotiate with the NHL. Because you think about it, they got to try and get these games off. And if you keep reading stories that are coming out of Japan, they've got some more issues with COVID and fans and the vaccination rates. Like, they're just trying to get these games pulled off. And it's not to say they can't specifically have someone negotiate with Gary Bettman for the Winter Olympics, but I do have a concern that if we don't hear something really soon up into or when the games do start in Tokyo, that it's going to be very negative in terms of fans not seeing NHL players in the Olympics.
Shouldn't they just be negotiating with the IIHF here, though? Shouldn't this be a Renee Fassell conversation?
I don't know how it works.
It seems like that's the major stakeholder here to me, and yes, the IOC is the overarching umbrella for this entire operation. But that's kind of been the sticking point in the past, hasn't it? Bettman and Fassell going head-to-head, and maybe Bettman sort of moves off to the side, and it's a Players Association discussion, in this case headed up by Donald Fehr. I'm not sure exactly what that's going to look like, but it feels more like that to me, Karen, than it does to what we've seen in the past with those two going head-to-head and being combative on where the cost should be, and Fassell coming out and saying, hey, this is great for the growth of the game. We need to do this for the sport. And Bettman saying, okay, what's in it for us? Feels like this is more in the players' hands now than it is actually in Bettman's.
Rene Fassell is about to end his presidency. I did remember that from the World Hockey Championships. He was handing out for the last time any sort of international medals. I don't know when his candidacy comes to end. I don't know if that has anything to do with it. I mean, maybe it does a little bit. Maybe it's just waiting for his successor. I don't know. Again, I don't exactly know when his successor is, but with the insurance part of this, Bettman did make a note, and you know, I booked a trip and I didn't, you know, put the deposit down, but I also had to put down insurance for a trip cancellation and then separate COVID insurance. And that's just for a trip you're hoping to have in February. I can only imagine what insurance costs, first of all, to go to the Olympics. And then if you're going to add COVID insurance for all these NHL players and what that entails. And Bettman said yesterday he wasn't quite sure what the cost would be for that. It's pretty insignificant in terms of a trip to probably Mexico. You know, it's only $65 for the entire trip. But when you're talking about going to Beijing, you're talking about protecting these players and staff, it just adds up. So I do understand why this could be, it's very different from other Olympics just because of the pandemic we are in. But yeah, the insurance seems to be a pretty sticking point at this point. And if someone's not going to pay for the COVID on top of the rest of it, we could not see NHL players again, Scott.
We will. I just don't know if it'll be this year. I think it will be this year, Karen. I do think it's trending that way. The players really want to go. As many factors as there were to discuss last year, when they were trying to get a season back on track and trying to put a CBA in place and get an extension worked out, which they were able to do, and Bettman gave himself a pat on the back and the players a pat on the back for that last night. Hey, remember, despite everything we've been through in the last year, 15 months, we managed to get a CBA extension here and extend our labor agreement. That's fair. We complimented the league and the players about that at the time. It was important enough then for the players to get on board with this. I get the sense it'll be important enough now. I think we see Olympic participation from NHL players this year.
I hope so, because what was it, the tweet I saw? Connor McDavid would be 28 and Nate MacKinnon would be 29, 30 or something by the first time we'd ever see them play in Olympic competition. And the other sad part of that is the fact that Sidney Crosby would probably not be playing 3 years, 4 years time in, I don't even know when, where is that one being held again? I don't even know. But 4 years time after Beijing, I want to see it happen. That's all. That's all I got to say.
Well, I had to wait a really long time for Gretzky. We had to wait until Gretzky was 37. Ah, these guys are just young bucks compared to 99 when he finally got his opportunity to go to the Olympics. We don't need to go down that rabbit hole right now. Let's get to what they're saying. We mentioned this off the top as part of our recap of last night's game, look ahead to what's still going on in the Stanley Cup final between the Bolts and the Habs. All right, you got to go back to game 5. There are all the hockey storylines associated with that. There's a pretty significant weather story associated with that as well. There is a tropical storm approaching the state of Florida. It's going to hit Tampa Bay at some point this evening or really early tomorrow morning, Eastern Standard Time. Dominique Ducharme, who found his team still alive after last night's overtime victory, had this to say about flying into those weather conditions and everything going on outside the rink.
It's no surprise anymore. I think anything that happened right now and for a while, we just take it and look at it and say, it's probably part of our destiny. It's been crazy, but we're a crazy bunch of guys in here, and we're going to take that challenge.
We're a crazy bunch of guys in here.
We're a crazy bunch of guys, so we're going to go into a crazy tropical storm. It's Tropical Storm Elsa. They're going to close down. Now, Montreal and Tampa Bay, and I believe the media contingent, are going to arrive in Tampa Bay before this happens. But at 5 p.m. Eastern tonight, they're closing the airport until 10 a.m. tomorrow morning. Then they're going to assess some damage. So they're expecting pretty high winds, and we'll see what happens in that state. But it just kind of adds to the, okay, the game may be postponed because, yeah, there's a tropical storm that's going through Tampa Bay.
If they're planning on reopening the airport tomorrow by 10 a.m. for commercial flights, they don't expect the damage to be so significant that it would cause this to not happen as far as the hockey game tomorrow goes. But your point is a very good one. Mother Nature, when Mother Nature decides to step up, we don't have an answer, quite frankly. So let's hope that for the people of Florida, this doesn't go particularly bad, let alone the hockey. Elliot Friedman, Jeff Merrick, they've been doing this after every single Cup Finals game. They do a car cast, or in this case, a hotel cast, as Elliot was in Montreal and getting ready to go down to Florida on that media charter you just spoke about. They went through the game last night, had a bunch of different takes on that, and then hit a couple of topics from around the league, including what the update is on the Jack Eichel situation.
I think the only thing that's suddenly becoming an issue here is, if you don't do this soon, is the acquiring team going to be comfortable that Eichel's going to have enough time to recover to be ready for next year? Mm-hmm. And again, the ask is really high. You know, there's one team out there, and someone from there just said, you wouldn't believe what the ask is. And I said, well, what is it? And they go, I can't tell you now. Maybe later. And every day I text this person and I say, is it later? And they say, no, we can't do it. I just think the ask is really high. We'll see. I mean, they've really tried to keep a lid on that after everything that happened when it first started. But there's at least one team out there I've heard that is this saying, if this isn't soon, we're out.
So what struck me about this was just the fact that he hasn't had anything done yet surgical-wise, and we don't know what the recovery for what procedure he's going to have, and will he be able to play next year? And any team going in is going to want some sort of medical being done if they can figure out a trade. We saw with the Victor Arvidsson, and Elliot reported this, the last thing that they finally got through was the medical report for Victor Arvidsson because he had been injured, and LA just wanted to make sure everything was okay and clear before they made that trade. And you think about this, like, this would have been, there's a Seth Jones, there's Dougie Hamilton. Like, I know this is not a free agent, this is a trade, but this would have been the one big shoe to kind of fall, maybe, or the biggest offseason attraction, because he's a top-line center that you just don't have available for a team. So if he's not healthy by the time free agency starts, or when we start to see silly season start, it just kind of makes you wonder where Jack Eichel will end up by the end of the season.
Well, and as Elliot is referencing off the top, because they discussed this for a little bit longer, he's talking about the team and the player coming to a conclusion on what the path forward is medically. The Sabres to this point have said, we're not okay with the surgery. We've asked our doctors. They've consulted experts. We don't think this is something that we're okay with. We're going to go with the natural healing process or alternative methods to surgery here. Eichel has wanted surgery, so one of two things happens. Either the medical team comes around and says, okay, we're more on board with the surgery now, get the surgery done, and an acquiring team is also of that opinion, or Eichel's camp says, okay, we're going to do this your way because that opens up trade avenues, and we need to get this done soon because the player needs to be healthy enough to play next season. It'll be interesting to update. It is one of, if not the biggest chips, as you just talked about, Karen, on the trade market this year. I don't think it has to happen before other deals happen, but certainly it changes the equation for certain teams that have the ability to be active if they get in on the Jack Eichel sweepstakes or if they do not.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's just, he's a top-line center that wants a change of venue, and you think he's going to be pretty motivated. You hope that all the baggage, not talking medical baggage, but the mental baggage of being in Buffalo from the past years doesn't come with them. And you think, okay, if I'm getting a Jack Eichel, I'm getting a motivated guy that I think can win. And I'm not surprised what Elliot said, the agent or the GM that he talked to said the ask is massive. It's going to have to be. Kevin Adams got roasted for the Taylor Hall deal. He's going to want a massive haul in return, picks, players, what you name it. But it's just, this is a situation I thought would be resolve sooner than later in the offseason, and it at this point it just kind of leads you to believe that it might take a little while if in fact he does finally get moved.
Stanley Cup final continues tomorrow down in Tampa Bay, NBA final, I should say. It was going Bay to NBA. Didn't do that very smoothly. Chris Paul, he is in his first ever NBA finals, and they open tonight. Here's what he had to say about this opportunity.
It's still basketball. I think we all locked in to, you know, the goal at hand, and not much, just, I don't know. It's weird, no games being on. I usually watch games every day, so that's probably the part that sucks. That's probably the part that sucks the most, but I'd rather be playing than not.
So they're well rested because they haven't been playing for quite a long time. Pretty stoked to see Chris Paul play in the NBA Finals. I was thinking about this more last night, Scott, because we talked about on the show yesterday, kind of like, what are the storylines? What are the draw for the casual fan? But the more I thought about it, the more like, I'm going to get pumped up for this, at least early on. The two teams played within 1 point of each other in the regular season. The Suns coming out on top both times. One of those games went to overtime. Yes, Giannis Antetokounmpo played in those two games. He's not there. That's okay. I'm just kind of interested to see. I'm just trying to talk myself into it. I think I'm going to, because I want to see Chris Paul win a championship. I want to see Devin Booker on this big stage. And I want to see if Milwaukee can do the miraculous without Giannis Antetokounmpo.
If he, in fact, doesn't play. Now, he's listed as doubtful, but we've all seen a lot of things change medically during the course of these playoffs. Something we can get into throughout the course of this week and certainly later in the show. Where would you put Milwaukee winning a championship compared to Toronto winning a championship? I do think there's a comparison to be had here in terms of market validation, sending a message, something nobody thought could be done. What does it do for the league? What does it do for teams that aren't considered A markets in the NBA? We can talk about that. Those two teams have made their way through the NBA bracket. We're going to focus on a different bracket next. Yeah, we'll talk some Stanley Cup with Carolyn Cameron. But Felix and Chapo, those names are coming up. I can guarantee you that next on Rentoul and Sermon.
Now back to Rentoul and Sermon.
We've had a lot of texts on this, so we want to continue to filter them in ahead of Carolyn Cameron, who will join us here. First time visiting with her this month. It's been a while since we've talked to Carolyn. Always a pleasure for both of us. It's Rentoul and Sermon, and thanks to all of you who have chimed in and are listening here in the early part of July. 960-960 or 650-650. Sam Bennett is a guy that looks a lot older than he is. No question. That is a great one. It has everything to do with that big stash and beard.
I mean, considering his nickname will always be and forever be 18-year-old Sam Bennett, but yes, he definitely looks a lot older when he went, especially when he went to Florida, and I guess he had the stash in Calgary earlier this year, but that stash that he has is pretty impressive. Greg Oden is a good one. I don't know if you said that earlier, but a couple of our listeners have said Greg Oden looked 35 in even when he was 19, when he was drafted first overall coming out of Ohio State. Again, just one of those guys you wonder, what if he had been healthy, because he was so dominant, and would the big man have continued in the NBA if he could have stayed healthy, because he was kind of the next one to come in. But he did. Again, it has to do with the big beard that he was able to grow, Scott. But yes, that's a very good one. He looked a lot older than he was.
It's a very good one. You're right. He did. Sam in Coquitlam says LeBron James, he's looked 40 since the day he was drafted and hasn't changed. I disagree with that. Physically, like in terms of having a man's body when he was 18, mm-hmm. LeBron looked older than 18 years old simply because he was way more physically developed than most 18-year-olds you see. We were talking about this earlier, and maybe it's something we get into with Carolyn Cameron here in just a few minutes. Denis Shapovalov. Completely mm-hmm. different sport, different player, all of those things. But Shapovalov, in the last year and change, has really grown into his body, and he's filling out physically. Now, Felix Auger-Aliassime has a different makeup. Like, his body type is different than mm-hmm. Shapo's, but you're going to see him start to fill out. But Shapo, you can really see it now, and you compare him to the guy that we thought of first and burst onto the scene against Rafa and winning that game as this string bing wiry kid. He's not that anymore. Like, he's got some heft to him all of a sudden.
There was one tournament, and I can't remember which one it was, but it was a specific, we hadn't seen him play in a little while, and I guess it was probably early on last year, and it could have been the Aussie Open right before the pandemic. But when he came back and you were like, okay, he started to fill in with his body, and you know, boys mature a little bit later, so the fact that he was able to get in the gym and the gym was to take effect, but you did notice, you're like, okay, his chest looks a lot bigger and his legs look a lot bigger, like he's just able to fill in. Like you said, Felix he's a bit taller and he's a bit more lengthy in his body type. He will fill in a bit too, get to the gym and a little bit more, but right now it works for him. But you do see that Shapovalov, just once he turned, maybe it was 19 to 20, Scott, or 20 to 21, and just all of a sudden, just that he just became more of a specimen out there, if I can say that.
Mitch Marner looks 15 is another one that came in. Yeah, Marner looks young, but the other one that's come in a couple of times I think is actually even better, and that's Ryan Nugent-Hopkins. He looks younger than he actually is.
He always looked like the kid. He always, he does. He's, how old is he now? 29? Is that what it was? 30? I don't even know. But it's, and signed, yeah, 30, because he signed an 8-year deal. He'd be 38 at the end of this. But he will always look like he's about 15 years old. It's because it's the Sidney Crosby syndrome, right? And I say that in the, I say that in the most complimentary way. It's, you can't grow the facial hair. Right? Like, Nuge is going to be one of those guys you're trying to, if they, Oilers, ever make like a playoff run, it's going to be one of those Sidney Crosby, patchy, can't really grow in facial hair, and he just makes him look younger.
Okay, we can't prematurely age him. He is only 28 years old. Nuge is 28. Okay. He turned 28 in April, but it's right in the exact same ballpark. I know what you're talking about with the facial hair, though. That's absolutely a part of it.
That was always the thing with Sidney Crosby. It was just like, oh, poor Sid. Just can't get that. He can't get that playoff beard. Also, too, is there a point where you stop adding kid to the nickname? Like,
yes.
Little Bow Wow became Bow Wow. But isn't it still Sid the Kid? Or have we dropped that moniker?
It comes up every once in a while. Probably a better question for Carolyn Cameron. She would field this question far better than I host on Sportsnet, of course, and one of our favorite guests to have on the program. Carolyn, thanks for doing this today. How are you?
I would say he's no longer a kid.
Is it an age thing, or is it a 10-year thing? Like, is it when you get into your 30s, you can't be called kid anymore? Is it because he's been around for so long, we can't call him kid, maybe even prior to the age of 30?
Yeah, I think it's also a thing. Like, if he's, 33? I could see maybe, like, a 55-year-old calling him a kid, but not if you're right around his age.
He turns 34 next month. He's got one of the easier birthdays to remember on the calendar. I certainly don't commit most athletes' birthdays to memory, but when you're born on 8-7 in 87 and you wear 87, it's kind of a constant reminder.
Actually, here's a funny tie-in, kind of, because I know we'll be talking tennis, if I will, is I remember one year at the Rogers Cup in Toronto, Roger Federer's birthday is on August 8th, and I walked into the media room and Crosby was there, and he and Federer were like both blowing out the candles on a joint birthday cake. And Felix Auger-Aliassime actually shares a birthday with Roger Federer. So that's a lot of greatness in a couple days.
And he is almost exactly half Roger's age.
Yeah, correct.
Well, why don't we start with tennis? Karen, you've been champing at the bit to get talking about Felix and Chapo, so you lead this one off.
Hey, Caroline, I was watching these matches yesterday, and let's start first with Chapo. It was a straight sets victory. First two sets looked pretty easy, but then the nerves and maybe a little bit of the, you know, straight sets anxiety started to creep into his game. You saw a little bit more sloppiness, but I was really impressed that he was able to pull it together and still win in straight sets. To me, it showed a little bit more of the mental maturity that we've been looking for in his game.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think what's really cool with he and Felix is I know it feels like Dennis especially has kind of been around for a while because he had his big breakthrough in Montreal when he upset Rafael Nadal back in 2017. So we're talking about 4 years ago next month. But, I mean, he's still just 21 years old. And it's really been neat to see him develop and grow. And he even told, or he's 22, I guess, now. He even told TSN after the match just how he can tell that he's kind of calmed down in these tougher big situations. He's calmer. He's been working with a sports psychologist. So it's just been nice seeing him grow and kind of be able to grow out of situations where in the past he would have lost.
When you look at Felix's match yesterday, easy straight set. First two sets look pretty decent and easy against Zverev, and then he loses the second, third and fourth, sorry, the next two. And then the fifth, they have a bit of a rain delay, but he got the early break, and then he got a late break as well. And to me, again, this was like a stepping stone that he needed in his career, especially going against Zverev, number four in the tournament, number seven in the world. It just looked like one of those matches where you can go, you can kind of pull from this and say, this was a signature victory for me.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think this was honestly a huge breakthrough for him because he's been in eight finals in his career, two of them this year in Stuttgart and Melbourne, and he is 0-8 in those finals. So he has not been clutch, and that's been one of his biggest problems in his young career. So the fact that he beats Zverev, as you mentioned, the upset, number four seed, someone he'd never even won a set against, and then even those first two sets, it was down 2-4, won those, and the fact that he regrouped and was able to win, that's something he hasn't been able to do in his young career. So I think for him, confidence-wise, that's just a massive breakthrough. And then you even think back to a couple weeks ago when he upset Roger Federer. Mm-hmm. on the grass courts of Halle. I know it's not the same stage as Wimbledon, but that's Roger frickin' Federer on grass. So the fact that he has both of those under his belt, it's a really nice, as you put it, stepping stone to whatever's next. And it's just fitting that whatever's next is a Wimbledon quarterfinal and his first ever Grand Slam quarterfinal.
It's funny you say that. Carolyn Cameron joining us here on Rintoul and Sermon, because Karen asked me on the air yesterday, is this the big step we've been waiting for both of these players? And I said, no, I want to see them in the semifinals. And after I got off the air and I thought about it more, I went, we lump these two guys together too often. This is a big step for Felix. I feel like Chapo should be in and around the quarterfinals based on his ranking, based on being a little older as well. Is that fair to look at it that way, or do you lump them in together when it comes to progression?
Yeah, you know what? That's an interesting question, because I do kind of lump them in together when I look at skill set and where they should be. Dennis had faster success, and again, that's just because of his age, and it was almost more flashy success. Felix is really, like, even the way they both play is completely different too. So that has to kind of, it has to kind of put a little bit pressure on us to change our mindset. Like, Dennis really goes for his shots. He plays kind of fearless tennis. Felix is more to me, like, I love watching him play. It's just beautiful tennis. It's almost like ballet, how Roger Federer plays. But for him, he's so consistent on the court, and sometimes that can work against him in the big moments. So I think it's honestly like quarterfinals for Chapo. If he doesn't reach the semis, that's totally fine. It's still an excellent tournament. I do like his chances against Khachanov. And for Felix, it's kind of like whatever happens now would be awesome. His next match is a little tricky in the sense that it's Berrettini, who's a young Italian, like one of his best friends on tour, Felix is, and he just won his first title on the grass at Queen's Club. So for both of them, this is kind of uncharted territory. They'll both be nervous. They both really respect each other, but just because of their age and circumstance, I think it's a bit of a coin flip. So sorry, that was kind of a roundabout way of answering your question. I do loop them in together because of their similar age, but you're right. They're very different players, and it is different circumstances for both.
And you, over the last couple of years, have patiently put up with me talking about my dream for these two being the Sampras and Agassi, even though it's exactly comparable to that. You've patiently heard me talk about this, and I've talked about Chapo and the Agassi comparison. And one thing Agassi had to do with his game was become more judicious with when he was trying to go for kill shots and the big shots. And I see more of that now with Chapo. He still has that flair to his game, and he still hits those winners, and that's still in his DNA, but he's becoming more choosy. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I remember a few years ago, like, he would always look to paint the line, or not even paint the line. Like, it would be more out than it was in, but it was still in. Like, paint the outside of the line. Where now he's a lot more, he's smarter with his shots, but you're right, it's in his DNA. He'll still go for those big shots when he wants to, but, and that's what makes him fun to watch. Like, he honestly is, I know it's cliche, but a fan favorite because of how he plays and he shows his emotions on the court. Felix is more reserved on the court. You don't know exactly what he's thinking, kind of like Federer.
Scott and I had this discussion yesterday, and he asked me the question. I said, Felix and Chapo are not quite there yet. And that's in terms of, let's say there's still the big three, Roger, Rafa, and Djokovic. But then there's that next generation, the Tsitsipas, the Zverevs, the Daniil Medvedevs of the world. And then is Chapo and Felix, are they in the third tier, or can we put them in that second tier yet with the other next gen younger players?
Yeah, I think they're in that second tier, and they both still need to win a major tournament to kind of officially get there. But the fact that Felix beat Zverev in a tough five setter at Wimbledon, I think kind of clinches it. It's really, to me right now, like Djokovic, then Nadal, then everyone else. And I'm really happy to see, I'm also a Federer fan, I'm happy to see him through to the quarters. But he's going to be 40 next month. I still don't have the highest hopes for him at Wimbledon. It's not the Federer that we used to know, who is so dominant. So I'd say it's Djokovic far and above the rest, and then Nadal, and then this next group. But I think Felix and Dennis are in it now.
Djokovic, obviously the favorite to win this tournament again. That would put him at 20 majors, tying him with Rafa and with Roger. And we've had the discussion on the show before. For him to be the all-in-out greatest tennis player ever and not be in the argument or discussion with Rafa and Roger, is it just reaching 21 majors? Or for him, because of everything that kind of goes with him, his personality and off the court, does he have to kind of get to that 24, 25 range?
I think it's always going to be a discussion as to who's the greatest, regardless of what the Grand Slam count is, just because it's such passionate fan bases, even within the tennis community, for each player. So as you said, if Djokovic reaches 20, you could argue that he's the greatest of all time because he also has winning records against Federer and Nadal, where they don't, right? That's when you kind of look at the head-to-head, I think. And you know what's funny? I remember just going into the living room and I had Wimbledon on and there was kind of this little piece on Federer and about how it's not just the titles that make you the greatest of all time. It's kind of how you play and how you dominated in your time. And I was like, oh, this is a pretty good feature. And then it was a Rolex commercial. that convinced me. I think it's always going to be a discussion, even if he finishes with 24. Because he's younger than Federer and Nadal, and because they weren't all at their peak at the exact same time, it'll be a discussion.
It's a great conversation and a great debate to have. Carolyn Cameron joining us here on Rintoul Sermon for a few more minutes. On the women's side, we're not having the discussion about Bianca being further in this tournament. She left in the opening round, and this has been a concern since she won the U.S. Open. Can she stay healthy? We've been worried for quite some time. Are you concerned right now, or are you, don't worry, it's been a weird couple of years because of COVID and everything that's gone with it, this will be fine?
Yeah, I'd say I'm worried, but I'm not concerned. I think, and you kind of said my answer, like I think just based on the year it's been, based on the fact that she kept battling injury, and then she came back and is still battling injury. And then you even look, though, at the Miami Open this year. Like, she made it all the way to the final. And then she had to retire in the final against Ash Barty. So I still think, from watching Bianca, when she is healthy, she's one of the best in the world because she has so many different weapons to beat her opponent with. So many tools in her toolbox and so many terrific shots. But again, the thing is, okay, well, can she consistently stay healthy? So I'm hoping in 2022, even once things really hopefully return to normal, we'll get a better sense of where she is. So yeah, I think I'd just put it simply that way. I'm worried, but I'm not overly concerned.
I'm not sure what you thought of Montreal coming into this postseason, but as we turn our attention back to a Stanley Cup final that's going on, at what point did you become somewhat enamored with the story, assuming that you got there at some point during this run?
Yeah, so I'm one of the idiots who thought that the Leafs would take care of them no problem, and then I thought the Jets would beat them, and then I thought for sure that Vegas would beat them. I thought whoever won the Colorado series and Vegas series was going to win the Stanley Cup, so I've basically been wrong with all of my predictions, which is not great. Montreal is interesting, because even last year in the bubble, like, here's a team who only got into the playoffs last year because there was the revised format because of the pandemic. So they come in and then they play really well. And then headed into this regular season, there was kind of the thought of, well, that was kind of lucky and they're not as good as they were then. It was kind of a flash in the pan. Then they come in, have a great start to the regular season led by their blue line. And I think I've kind of rethought how I'm going to look at the regular season from here on out, because I think we get distracted in a way by all the skill and offense because it's so flashy and fun. And then when it comes playoff time, you look at teams like Montreal or like the New York Islanders who don't have the big star names. They're not perhaps the sexiest of teams, but they get the job done and they shut you down. So shame on me for overlooking that aspect of the Montreal Canadiens. I think for them, it also was a case of getting hot at the right time, which history has shown is a big part of the playoffs and even going on to win the Stanley Cup. I was really happy to see Montreal last night play really well and have Price play well and get the win. I still think Tampa's going to take the series and win the Stanley Cup, and I'd actually be surprised if it didn't happen tomorrow. But considering how good Montreal has been and how good Price has been, it was nice to see him get back into form in the Stanley Cup final.
And Caroline, you talked about their defense, and a man on a mission last night was Shea Weber. I mean, I don't know what he has against Braden Point, but he had something against him in the game yesterday. Save for that four-minute high stick at the end of the game, I'm actually really happy it didn't end with him in the box, because he looked like a guy last night that didn't want to let Montreal, or the fact they didn't want Tampa Bay to win the Stanley Cup on Montreal's home ice.
I agree, and I think this is a blue line that even in the bubble last year, when the season was over, before their additions and before even having Romanov come along, you could look at them, and led by Shea Weber and Petrie, you could argue that they're not only one of the best blue lines in the Scotia North Division, but even across the league. And I think a lot of people always think of Shea Weber, if you're kind of a casual hockey fan or not a hardcore Montreal Canadiens fan, you kind of think of him as the, okay, yeah, he's a veteran and he's big, but it's mostly that really hard shot that's scary. But he leads by example, and he's such a big body, and he uses that body, and he hustles, and even at his age, he's still got his legs in him. So yeah, he's one of the big strengths of the Montreal Canadiens. And even though he's captain, I think sometimes he's a little bit underappreciated league-wide.
I agree with that. And when he plays a game like last night, boy, do the appreciation threads get started again on Shea Weber. It's been a fun final for a bunch of different reasons. I do wonder if some of that attrition takes its toll on Tampa Bay heading into tomorrow night. I'm with you. Tampa Bay still wins this series. This isn't the Leafs we're talking about here. Haven't won before. Tampa knows how to get the job done. And ultimately, whether it's tomorrow, later in the week, I do think they ultimately close this out. I wonder if we're going to see Braden Point tomorrow. I really hope so, because he came back in that hockey game. But sometimes, and you know this, Carolyn, sometimes you have that whatever he needed to do to get himself ready to play the third period. Short-term pain, long-term gain, you hope. I don't know. I'm worried about him for tomorrow night, and I wonder how much of a loss that is for Tampa Bay if he's not there.
Yeah, I think it would be a really big loss, and I think he's in the conversation. I still think Kucherov and Vasilevsky are above him in terms of Conn Smythe, but he's right there for what he's done, especially offensively in these Stanley Cup playoffs. And that's the thing with Montreal, too, that we've seen throughout the playoffs, and especially in that first round that kind of lit a fire under them against Toronto. All it takes is kind of one moment or one game to turn the tide and change things for Montreal. So again, even though I think Tampa's going to win and they're going to do it tomorrow, as I said, my track record these playoffs is not good with my prediction. So for any gamblers listening, maybe just go against what I'm saying.
Last one for you. We began with tennis. I want to end simply because we got this very succinct text that came in during the course of this conversation.
Oh.
We asked you about Felix. We asked you about Schapo. We asked about Bianca. Are we giving up on Milos? Was the question.
No, I never will. For Milos, though, and I think that's why people get kind of concerned about Bianca. For him, for many years now, it's actually just been about being able to consistently stay healthy. And I still have hope that he's going to be able to. He's not playing Wimbledon because of an injury. He announced he won't be playing the Olympics because he's still recovering. I believe the last injury he sustained was a calf injury. No, I'm not writing him off. I think it is concerned. Like, he kind of, it seems he had his moment, and especially where he is in his career in terms of health and age, it's easy to say, well, look at Felix, who's a decade younger than he is, and he's through to the quarterfinals at Wimbledon. But if Milos can consistently be healthy, I think he still has a real shot to go deep in tournaments.
I hope so, because it does feel like his success has been discounted, and maybe that has to do with personality as much as anything else, but he's right now the best singles tennis player this country has ever produced, and people seem to forget that.
Yeah, and I think, too, you know, it got me thinking, too, just right now, I think it's really nice for Bianca, Dennis, and Felix that they have each other, and they've said that a lot in terms of motivating each other and having that belief that, oh, gee, Bianca can win Indian Wells, the U.S. Open. I could do it too if you're Felix and Dennis. And they grew up together in their teens through the Tennis Canada system. When it was really just Jeannie on one side and Milos the other, just as fans in general and even media, it's okay, well, either you get the job done or you don't. Where now we have, they almost have, I know it's an individual sport, but teammates out there, right? Like, oh, if Felix does really well one week, that's great. If Dennis does well the next week, that's great. There's not as much pressure because there's more of them.
It's a really good point, and I'm not surprised in the slightest. I always hear those from you when you come on this show, and I appreciate you taking the time today. Enjoy the rest of your Tuesday, and thank you very much for making time.
No problem. Always fun talking tennis and hockey.
Thanks, Carolyn.
Thanks, Carolyn.
See ya.
I liked her answer on Milos. I'm a little bit more bullish on him now. I find it is to do with the health, but the way that the tennis game is, it's hard to win if it's one-dimensional. And it's not always just about Milos's serve. He does have a great forehand, but his court presence and his court movement is just not there like Felix and Chapo. If he's not dominating on a serve, he's going to get broken. He generally doesn't break the back the other way. Like, if he's going to win a set, it's probably going to be 7-6 in a tiebreaker. So for me, I'm a little bit more hesitant to say that we're going to see much more from Milos Raonic. Yeah, maybe some runs in some tournaments, but in terms of the Grand Slams and how far he can go in those and five setters, I just don't know if it's still in him at this point in his career.
Why do you think that the average Canadian sports fan, and I believe this to be the case, maybe you disagree with me on this, why do you believe the average Canadian sports fan discounts what he's done? He reached the Wimbledon final, which when I was growing up, Karen, was not even a pipe dream for a Canadian male tennis player. I love Daniel Nestor. I love everything he did for this country and what a phenomenal career he had, most of it on the double side, and beating Stefan Edberg back in the early 90s, way back in the day in a Davis Cup match. What Milos did is everything we didn't think was possible from a Canadian male tennis player. Is it because he hasn't always played for Canada? Is it because he has a lack of flair to his game and he's very calm and composed for the most part out there? What is it?
It could be personality. I could point to the fact expectations were very high for him at one point. He was number 4 in the world. You mentioned he made it to the Wimbledon final, but all of his tournaments are 250 events. It looks like, what I'm looking at here, maybe one 500 event. Like, all the events that he won were of the lesser quality, lesser quality with the competition that he had to face against. He just could never do it in on the bigger, grander scheme of things. And maybe because his game wasn't flashy. The personality's not, that's for sure, which is fine. You don't have to have a flashy personality on the court. Federer took until later in his life to show some flair and some, you know, high fist pumps out there and some screams. Like, he kept it pretty composed for most of his career. But it's with Milos, it was always just really one-dimensional, and it just didn't gravitate. It's not a game where you just say, that's a pretty style of tennis, or even a style of tennis that can win you multiple tournaments, multiple majors.
Personality is a really good segue here. Is there enough personality to get you to tune in? We'll tell you what we're talking about next on Rentoul and Sermon.